Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. I want to thank everybody for joining us here today for another edition of Midrats. For those that are joining us live, if you go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that is where you will find the chat room. That's a great place that if you have some observations during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would make sure that we would like to that you would like for us to direct to our guest during the course of the conversation, now please go ahead and put it in there. We'll both be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll do our best to fold that in as we progress for the next hour. And if you're new to the show and you want to catch up on some previous editions of Midrats, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can do the shortcut and just go ahead and go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the free podcast there. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with the show today. As we put out in some of the pre-show notices, today we've got a great guest on to talk about a couple of issues that are really coming to the front. If you're looking at your top five conversations you want to have for 2015 that carry on from the previous year, these are two, and we're going to bring in some other ancillary subjects as well. Earlier this year, hopefully a lot of y'all, if you didn't watch it live, at least had an opportunity to see the recording or at least the debate about the great carrier debate that took place between a couple of our friends here at the show, Jerry Hendricks, and our guest for today, Brian McGrath. And one thing that was clear from the debate is we could use a few more hours, as there's a lot more on that topic that I know that we're going to try to touch on here today, and that I think both of these gentlemen would be continuing the discussion via other venues. Good thing to keep an eye on. And Brian, for those that aren't familiar with him, he is the founding managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group. It's a consultancy specializing in naval and national security issues, including national military strategy, strategic planning, executive communications, strategic communications, and also emerging technologies. Prior to starting Ferry Bridge, Brian started a national security consulting line of business for Dell Tech Systems, where he directly supported a number of senior clients in both the Army and the Navy. He, on a regular basis, provides some critical insight on Navy policy and acquisition preferences to commercial clients, including defense contractors, small technology firms, and also negotiating post-earmark era programs. Not just a think tank guy, Brian is a retired naval officer. He spent 21 years on active duty, including a tour in command of the USS Bulkley, which I always mispronounce, and so I'm sure he'll correct me later, a guided missile destroyer homeported over in Norfolk. He got his BA from the University of Virginia back in 87, and he also has an MA in political science from the Catholic University of America. He is also a graduate of the Naval War College. Brian, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Really appreciate you coming on time. And I really enjoyed actually being there in person. For those that have just seen the debate about the debate, they really need to get hold of the archive over on C-SPAN over in the Mahan Theater. Really was a great venue for a debate. And for those that want to get involved in debate of naval issues, really any issues, I just wanted to start off by commending both you and Jerry. Y'all put on the 21st Century Gentleman's Debate up there. Great format, but even better, great style and substance from both of you.
It was a lot of fun, and I hope people that watched and listened got something out of it. And like you said, I wish it could have gone on longer. I was certainly prepared to go on a lot longer, and it went very quickly.
Well, that's why I kind of said in the intro that I know that you and Jerry both have a lot more that you want to contribute to the discussion. And the discussion is not going anywhere because it really ties in to not just a shipbuilding budget or what line on a defense budget we're talking about, but and one thing we'll try to bring in the course of the hour it really gets to the core of what the maritime strategy is to support our national security goals, direction and guidance and everything else. And we've had Jerry on a few times before, and he's touched on some of his major critiques of the large carrier. And a lot of the arguments, whether you're talking about vulnerability, cost, or how it actually fits with the strategy that people see we're going to have in the next few decades. But you threw your hat in the ring with Jerry to kind of give the other side of the argument. What are some of those bold-faced items in support of the large deck carrier that you wanted to make sure and emphasize to the audience during the debate?
Well, one would be I'm perfectly willing as a naval thinker to question force structure, question investments, question the way we do business. The problem is I always like to I like to think that if we're going to question things and if we're going to walk away from capability, that there'll be something better that replaces it. And to this point, I have not yet been persuaded that there is anything that provides the same or better level of capacity and capability across the range of Navy functions as the aircraft carrier does. And I mean specifically across presence, moving up to deterrence, and finally into warfighting. Generally speaking, when others have first of all, it's easy to criticize the carrier. It's much tougher to put forward alternatives. Jerry, to his credit, has put forward alternatives. The problem is that the alternatives often sacrifice some large portion of the of what the carrier brings across those three areas. We have people that want to litter the South Pacific with small missile boats. I think that's a warfighting problem. I think that's a deterrence problem. It's certainly a nice presence platform, but you lose something in the warfighting and deterrence. Jerry would like to put a good deal more into the undersea realm, and quite frankly, I'm enamored with that idea, except that it leaves you then lacking in presence and in conventional deterrence. And so to this point, the biggest problem is that the alternatives aren't as effective as the aircraft carrier is. I'll leave that for now, and then I'm sure there's a ton more that I can talk about, but I want you guys to ask good questions.
Well, one of the arguments in favor of the carrier, or currently against the carrier, is that the aircraft currently in our fleet, the F-18 specifically, is not long-legged enough to strike from a range which would keep the carrier at a safe distance from opponents. But the counter-argument to that is that of all the things the carrier has is the flexibility that we can build those aircraft, either unmanned or manned, that have the range and thus have that capability. Is there an argument in there that I'm not seeing that would counter that?
Well, I mean, this is one of the things that I brought up in the debate, and that is it's an area where Jerry and I agree completely, and that is that we need to buy back range. We need to, we made conscious decisions when the wall fell and when our leadership at sea was unchallenged. We made decisions with the air wing, and we made decisions with the air wing that favored the delivery of precise weapons from a large number of sorties close to the beach. We made that the sine qua non of the aircraft carrier because, quite frankly, there was no one who could challenge us as we sat there close to the opponent's shoreline and generated sortie after sortie. That's not the way it was. It's not the way it always has been. We have had long-legged aircraft carrier air wings in the past. I mentioned in the debate the A5 Vigilante, whose range would be wonderful on today's air wing, except its stealth it would certainly be in jeopardy, and we would want something more stealthy. So this pursuit of an air wing that has striking power, appropriate for contested environments, that balances stealth, payload, and range, is something I think Jerry and I agree on completely. The problem is that, you know, he advocates very strongly for moving in this direction, as do I. The problem is then it's what do you do with it? And in my view, you put it on the largest, most flexible thing we operate, which is the aircraft carrier, because then you have the ability to strike in contested environments. You have the ability to perform C2 in those contested environments with the E2 or whatever follows it. We just haven't been able to come up with some other way of projecting naval power as flexibly, efficiently, and cost-effectively across the range of military operations as we do with the aircraft carrier. And so this generally is considered to be the most effective argument, one of the most effective arguments against the carrier. He has to get too close to the enemy shoreline. He's within all of these nasty weapons that the enemy can wield. Well, that's our choice. We chose to do that, and we can unchoose that. We can develop an air wing that brings us further away. And the further you get from these sources of his power, the lower becomes his probability of hit. This is just it's a physics issue, and I think it's not the carrier's fault that we have to operate closer. It's the carrier air wing's fault.
That's spot on. I was actually teasing my co-host here on our side chat. That's the next question I wanted to ask you, because the politics of the like strike mafia, you know, really is impressive what they accomplished to pretty much take care of the entire air wing. And it's that thing about the carrier that sometimes people lose in the argument, that it's not a tool. It is the ultimate toolbox that you can put things on depending upon how things change. And it's that inherent flexibility that I wanted to talk to you a bit about. Because a lot of the things that people want to replace the carrier with are to use the money that's being spent on carriers to do. It almost looks they're trying a little bit too hard to have a dialectic where the battleship gave over to the carrier, so the carrier has to give over to X. And it's defining X, it's curious. Some are looking at, you know, you should have your strike and your presence capability underwater. Well, the only way you do that, you know, SSGNs are going away. We're not replacing them. Or they really get focused on the unmanned portion, which isn't really mature enough to know where you're going. If you're crossing a ford in a stream, before you step on that next rock or log, you probably want to make sure it's a secure thing you're going to land on before you jump off. And the carrier proved itself to take over from the battleship. And are we not making the argument, and you kind of touched on in the previous answer, about the carrier is not your tool. It is your platform that you have the most capability to put your payloads on, and it helps you avoid the most potential, whether it's technology risk or the unknown change in the strategic environment in 10, 20, 30 years, that one thing we have been able to prove about the carrier is that inherent flexibility.
You know, the CNO, when he took over in his first year, began to talk about this payloads versus platforms, or payloads not platforms approach. And let's face it, the aircraft carrier is the ultimate payloads not platforms approach. Again, it's air wing changes to meet the strategic challenges that the Navy faces, and it's the air wing changes to meet the operational and tactical challenges. I talked about during the debate about the Enterprise's very first deployment, I think it was 1962 or 1961. It was to the Mediterranean. It did all these things. On the way back, it joined the armada that was forming to do the quarantine of Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they flew the A-5 Vigilantes, the long-range strike aircraft, off, and they flew on a number of Marine Corps A-4s so that they would have additional close air support planes. They did this on the fly. They didn't pull into a shipyard and have some multi-million-dollar integration. They changed the weapon system of that platform in a matter of hours. And this is something that the aircraft carrier has is built in. It is agnostic to, largely agnostic to what flies off of it. And I keep coming back to this. You know, there are many who say that the aircraft carrier is obsolete, as past its prime. Phil Pornell just wrote something on War on the Rocks where he said something very similar, and I think Jerry, if he doesn't believe that, he believes it's headed in that direction. I had a very, very senior member of the Navy flag community ask me a question as I was preparing for this debate and chatting with different people. He said, you know, I don't want to be the battleship admiral. How do I know when the aircraft carrier is obsolete? And I looked at him, and I thought about it for a few minutes because it's a damn good question. And I looked at him, and I said, I don't exactly know, but I know the exact day that it will happen. And he said, you know, like I was giving him some wisdom. He said, when is that? And I said, the day after land-based air is obsolete. Because carrier-based air will always be more relevant than land-based air simply because the carrier can move. And I think that's a reasonable way to look at this.
One of the debates that goes on in the carrier world, as you have discussed already, is the small carrier, you know, more small carriers versus a few large carriers. And one of the arguments, of course, is that the large carrier has a greater cycle rate. They can get more aircraft in the air more frequently than a small carrier. But is there, in your view, a cost benefit of going with smaller carriers that would allow us to have actually more presence and aircraft, or is that one of those issues that looks good on one side but really doesn't have any weight behind it?
I mean, there are arguments that I have heard and that I have read. The first thing to realize is that these aren't new arguments, right? The small carrier is something that's been raised time after time after time over the last several decades, and really smart, really honest, really hardworking analysts in the Navy continue to come up with the exact same answer every single time, that the large nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, because every drop of the fuel that it carries, give or take some for small boats and that sort of thing, and emergency generators perhaps, every drop goes into its weapon system. Every drop of some nearly 3 million gallons of fuels goes into its weapon system. The magazine space on the Ford-class aircraft carrier, the space to store weapons, is 23 times larger than the magazine on the largest amphibious assault ship that we currently have. 23 times. Jerry and others have talked about how the precision-guided weapons regime and the one-bomb, one-target paradigm has led us to this point where the sorties that the because the, you know, the large carrier proponents will point to the number of sorties that the Ford class is being developed to provide, and that sorties a larger number of sorties is less useful given the fact that we can put one bomb on one target every time we go up. This is something I've been thinking about quite a bit lately, and something that I am troubled because I think we have we have convinced ourselves that because it has been this way, it will ever thus be true. If we fight a major peer or near peer competitor, this one bomb, one bridge construct will go out the window in a heartbeat, because those targets will be heavily defended. And so in order to drop that one precise bomb on that one bridge, you're going to have to drop 20 or 25 bombs to take out the defenses around it. So we have walked away from mass and walked away from capacity over time because we have fallen in love with the technology and because we haven't had anybody to fight who could stress that technology. A peer or a near-peer competitor is going to make us fight a battle of mass, or at least more mass than we currently are comfortable with fighting with. And small carriers who can carry, I believe you need three. The well-deck carriers are a problem. I guess there's only two of those. The well-deck amphibs are a problem because that takes a lot of the fuel away. I believe six of those can carry the same amount of fuel as a Ford class carrier. I think it's three of the carriers that don't have the amphibs that don't have well decks have the same amount of fuel. And as I said, the magazine space is another issue. But putting that all aside, the lack of catapults is a big deal. What does that mean? It means you can't shoot large, heavy aircraft. Why do we need large, heavy aircraft? Well, we need large, heavy aircraft in order to, in at least one case, the E-2's case, to carry a large, heavy array, because that radar enables so much of what the carrier does. So that, at least, people talk about, well, the Brits put airborne early warning on helicopters in the Falklands War. I would suggest to you that that is not the direction we want to go. We want to be able to see farther, not less far. We need a plane that can get up into the atmosphere, not a helicopter that tops out at 10,000 feet. I mean, again, these are the aircraft carrier is large because it's useful. It's nuclear-powered because it's large. It's efficient because of its air wing. These are truths that are revealed time after time after time.
One of the cornerstones of the critique of the next class of the carrier, the Ford class, is the additional cost that it is over the old Nimitz class. And so that has to do with a new class, there's a lot of technology risk. You got to invest some more to build up and to learn. And one of the big parts of that is the new catapult system, the EMALS. Is the development and the installation of EMALS, is that a big part of the increase in the cost of the Ford carrier? And what are we buying with that extra investment in EMALS besides just the next technological evolution on how we catapult large aircraft off the carrier?
Okay, well, I will tell you, I horsed myself up on aircraft carrier design and naval architecture sufficiently, I thought, to conduct a 32-minute debate at the Naval Academy. I am not, however, an expert. I'll do my best to answer the question.
Sure.
The additional cost of the Ford class carrier, first of all, the planned cost of the Ford class aircraft carrier was significantly higher than the Nimitz. And that cost was due, as you cited, to the technologies that were going to be put in it. The cost overruns on the first of the class for most Navy ships, if not all, falls somewhere between 20% and 40% of the cost of that first ship. The latest figures for the Ford are that it is about 25% over what it was initially spec'd at. That, so that's one other discussion of cost. Now, we did this to ourselves. We, and I mean the U.S. military, did it to ourselves. There are something along the lines. It's not just EMALS. There was an entirely nuclear power plant in this carrier. There was an entirely new island with entirely new radars. There was an entirely new advanced arresting gear be put in. There were in total 14 major different technologies that were planned for this class that were going to be introduced over the course of the first three hulls. Mr. Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense during the Bush administration, a man I admire and who I have a lot of good things to say, was unsatisfied with how evolutionary or how revolutionary the first Ford class carrier was going to be, and he determined that those technologies would all be put into the first one. Anybody who understands ship acquisition knows that such a decision carries with it considerable risk, technical risk, and cost risk. And we have seen that risk come home to roost. The specific question you ask about the EMALS system, for one thing, it takes out a very maintenance-intensive steam system as we look to try and bring down the number of people that we have on aircraft carriers. That was one way of doing it. Secondly, the fine adjustments that are able to be made in the weight of what is being shot in EMALS is another attribute that its designers discuss. And finally, it has the ability to shoot significantly heavier aircraft than we are shooting today with our steam cap system, and shooting significantly heavier aircraft than the steam cap system currently has will help wear that steam cap out faster over the course of its life. And by that I mean larger, potentially larger unmanned vehicles, which nobody at this point can rule out. I think a lot of people, when they talk about what comes down the road for unmanned systems, naturally assume it's going to be some small airplane because it doesn't have to accommodate a human. That may or may not be true. Certainly some of them could be smaller because it doesn't have to accommodate a human, but not all of them have to be smaller if you're trying to get a payload, more payload in the air. So there, you know, I'm not an EMALS expert, but it is something that the naval aviation community believed was good for this, you know, 50-year lifespan of this group of carriers. So, you know, if you look at 10 carriers over 50 years, this is a 94-year program. And so there has to be flexibility for future technology built in, and one of the places they believed that flexibility was most needed was in the launching system.
Good answer. I'm sitting here looking at the chat room. There's a discussion going on about size of the carriers, and one of the thoughts I had was that if you had, we've got a bifurcated force. We've got the big carriers and their needed escorts and support vessels. We've got the potential. We have all these smaller carrier-like amphibs. Is there a way to, instead of launching E-2s and F-18s, is there a way to reinstitute having multiple aircraft but for different situations so that you have the functional equivalent of an A-10 launching from one of those amphibs, you know, with or without a catapult, so that we have a specific need being met by an airplane, instead of trying to make every F-18 or FA, whatever it's going to be next, be able to do all these multi-mission things. Is there an argument in favor of that, which will allow us to save some money on large deck carriers?
Well, again, I mean, it sounds as though that line of reasoning gets back to airplane and air wing design and air wing capability to some extent. The big deck amphibs with the F-35B are going to be a considerable capability. There's no question about it. We, and by we, I mean the Department of the Navy and both of its services, need to think very deeply about how that airplane is going to be used and its role in the full spectrum of maritime warfare. And by that, I mean blue water, green water, littoral, and overland littoral. I've talked a lot about and written about single naval battle and this desire for a more integrated Marine Corps and Navy in a new view of American sea power. And so I see a lot of potential in what that ship can do until such time as it launches its own C-2, until such time as it has the size and flexibility to accommodate sea control aircraft, which it doesn't. A smaller manner of projecting power ashore in a relatively uncontested environment. If that air wing is going to do its business in a contested environment, we will have to fight as an expeditionary strike force. It will have to have land-based AEW or carrier-based AEW with it. That's not a bad thing. I mean, that's just a way, that's a fleet architecture issue. But we can't get carried away with thinking that those ships can do what aircraft carriers do. They can't. They're part of a combat system that is purpose-built to deploy and support land power from the sea. The aircraft carrier and its escorts is a purpose-built, purpose-designed to control the seas and to project naval aviation air power ashore. Two different missions, two vastly different ships, and two different air wings. Now, could we develop UAVs someday that would take off from the LHDs and help enable that mission? God, I hope so. I really do. I think that would be great. But I think you're going to find that because of the small amount of deck space, the small amount of space to store airplanes, ultimately it will be less satisfying than in trying to accomplish similar results on a larger deck nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. We've danced around the cost issue, and I'll come back to that if you guys want to at some point. But the from a performance issue, the smaller LHA or LHD is always going to have performance issues compared to the large carrier. Size matters, guys. Size matters.
That's a good lead, and we'll leave the green eye shade behind. We don't want to put everybody to sleep.
All right. Crunching
the numbers. Instead of going down there, let's kind of shift the conversation a bit to something that I guess a man of a certain age can say this, something I found very sexy to come up in the conversation the last couple of months. At least for East Coast sailors, everybody knows the battle group gets together, does its Comp 2X, heads off for deployment. You're going to do a Suez transit. Well, when you do a Suez transit, you usually bleed off a few of your escort ships and leave them in the med. They're there to do presence missions, or like we did with our Enterprise deployment back in the late 90s, you can strike from one side of the Suez, strike from the other, and then send some people up into the Adriatic. And it's distributing that ability to project power from the sea, not just from the large deck aircraft carrier like we spent half an hour talking about. is we have surface ships, and the manifestation for that for most of our professional lives has been the T-LAM, and occasionally you get to play around with the 5-inch gun. But part of the conversation that's come up is talking about better utilizing our surface force to help project that power, the distributed lethality. So if you could, take for a minute to talk about that concept of distributed lethality and how that plays in to maybe a little bit of a renaissance on how we look at our surface force and how we can use that more than just following a carrier around.
Sure. So, again, this gets back to fleet design. And when the Soviet Union fell and the major sea control threat dissipated, the U.S. Navy looked at its fleet design and the weapons and sensors that supported it, and we made prudent budgetary decisions. And among those prudent budgetary decisions were that we would largely invest the carrier air wing with the anti-surface warfare, the offensive ASUW mission. We stopped fielding surface-to-surface missiles on our major combatants. This country has not produced a ship that can kill another ship organically over the horizon since the year 2000. DDG 78 was the last one. I think we're on like DDG 113 or 112 now, something like that. But we were going to fight differently. We were going to fight sort of more if we fought at all, we would fight in a more compact manner where the escorts would be around the carrier air wing would provide cover for the surface ships that would then provide defense for the aircraft carrier with these wonderful radars and surface-to-air missiles. It all made sense for that time. But then the times changed, and nations began to build and refine their navies, and they began, and specifically, I'll point to China, began to build a surface navy with considerably longer range surface-to-surface missiles than our surface fleet had. Certainly longer range than the Harpoons, which we field to this day on our cruisers and on DDGs number 51 through 78. So there came this feeling that we were being potentially outsticked, was the phrase that was used, that the other guy's range ring that you draw around his ships was considerably larger than our range ring, which put our surface forces even more in jeopardy. The one of the early shots across the bow in this distributed lethality question, unfortunately, I realize I'm probably opening Pandora's box with you, Sal, on this, happened with the Small Service Combatant Task Force mandate from the Secretary of Defense. And in a war game that was played up in Newport in March of 2014, medium-range surface-to-surface missile, far in excess of what Harpoon can do, was put on these constructive LCSs that played in that game, and those ships caused considerable angst for the other side in the game, specifically because he had to dramatically change the way he apportioned his ISR forces. And secondly, it changed the way he had to apportion his missiles across a larger number of potential targets, therein diluting the effectiveness of any one constructive attack. So the Surface Navy looked at this and said, well, wait a second. If this is so effective on LCS, why would we stop there? Why would we not begin to think more about increasing the lethality of virtually everything that floats? This this wasn't just a sense of, hey, let's make these ships more powerful because it would be fun to have weapons like we had in the 80s again. It was this sense that we were looking at, that the surface warfare community was looking at the president's strategy of pivoting to Asia and looking at what's happening in that incredibly large body of water, where there is also a lot of land, and this sense that the surface force can do more. Of course, let's face it, the surface force's first mandate is to provide the sea control necessary to project power, and that means we have to protect the high-value units, the aircraft carrier, the amphibious ready group, and the logistics forces. Those are what makes our ability to project power go. Surface force has to do that. But, you know, there are more surface ships than are necessary in a wartime scenario to just protect those high-value units. And the surface force looked at those platforms and said, if we made these guys more of a problem for the other side, and then we operated them differently in what they're calling the hunter-killer SAGs, not in some kind of foolhardy charge of the light brigade into the teeth of the Taiwan Strait kind of a thing, but in the outer edges of a potential strike reconnaissance complex, where we would want to be able to operate with our allies in a wartime situation, to help reprovision allies during a wartime situation, to create mayhem that the other guy has to deal with. As our power projection forces then slowly roll up and roll in the effectiveness, we thought the surface force can do more. And I say we because I helped with some of the thinking behind this, but Admiral Roden and Admiral Fanta really spent a lot of time thinking about this at the operational level of war. What can we do to create more of a problem for the other side so that our power projection forces can be even more effective? That's what's behind distributed lethality. Make everything that floats more powerful and more of a pain in the ass for the other guy, and then operate those ships in different ways. Go back to the future. Go back to surface action groups. You know, a surface action group that pairs a Flight 3 DDG with one of the DDG 1000s and an ASW configured LCS gives you the ability to do a lot of damage against land targets, a lot of damage in the outer air battle, a lot of damage against ships on the surface of the ocean, especially if we do the right thing and get a missile onto those Flight 3 destroyers and backfit them onto all the 2 Alpha destroyers. And all of those ships have very effective undersea warfare suites. I think that's an indigestible little ball of naval power that you can operate in environments where you have done the risk calculation and said it's worth them operating there for the payoff we can get. That's what's behind distributed lethality.
Well, I've been fascinated by it as a surface warfare guy myself who spent some time on all destroyers. But, you know, we're talking, I think we had Brian Clark, and he was talking about the offensive surface force. And, you know, I keep going back to Admiral Sobrowski and some of the original thoughts behind the Street Fighter concept and these M-class stiletto boats, which with a couple of motherships, you could throw a lot of those things out there. You could arm them kind of the way the Chinese arm their whatever that thing is, the Hu Hong or whatever it is, the one that's got, you know, missiles goes fast, and we could cause all kinds of problems. I mean, I'm in love with the concept, and some of those smaller vessels would not be that expensive. You could put a lot of out in a hurry, sort of a counter swarm, if you will, to a lot of things we've seen from potential opponents. Why is it suddenly you know, what is stopping us from moving ahead with these concepts?
All right. So the first thing to do is to pay credit where credit is due. Guys like Wayne Hughes at the postgraduate school and Jeff Klein and Jerry Hendricks and Phil Pornell and Chris Rawley have been talking about more distributed firepower for years. The problem is that in general, and it's not a criticism across all of those great thinkers, but in general, what they would do is they would do so at the expense of high-end and amphibious naval power. They would say, let's trade carriers and amphibs for fleets of missile boats. I believe that's too high a price to pay. And ultimately, we can gain some measure of the goodness that they suggest in distributing firepower by distributing it more uniformly across the ships we already have, which are under-resourced and under-provided in terms of offensive power today. Don't get me wrong. I want fast little missile boats. I want 100 of them all over Southeast Asia, operating with our friends. I want to sell them to our friends and allies. I want composite squadrons. I want all of that. I don't want it if it costs me aircraft carriers or it costs me amphibious ships, because those are the things, that kind of power projection, are the kind of things that only the United States Navy can do. Other navies can do those other things, and we can work with other navies to perhaps build up their capabilities in those areas. But only we do that high-end power projection warfight. And as long as naval thinkers who want to trade one for the other, as long as they talk in those terms, they're going to lose my support. The very concept of distributing firepower more uniformly is a great idea, and credit must be given to those great naval thinkers.
Kind of the other side of the coin from distributed lethality is, for lack of a better phrase, distributed vulnerability. Not specifically for carriers, but a lot of our large surface combatants, and really our number of amphibious ships as well. Have we done an economy of scale with larger ships and larger capabilities in a smaller number that we've reached the point that we're losing? Because when ships go to sea and ships go to war, ships get sunk, but fleets still have to fight. Have we reached the point that we're at a strategic risk where you lose one ship to a mine or a submarine or even a mechanical failure, that you don't have the bench to continue forward to try to accomplish the mission? And if you wanted to, if you're just looking at carrier numbers, you know, I remember when we were both kids during a Desert Storm, you got four carriers in the Red Sea. You have even more than that between the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea that we just plain can't do now. Is there a certain number with our large deck amphibs and with our carriers that we are at a point that we just can't take a hit and keep fighting?
That's a good question. Let me take it in stages. The first stage is in the kind of high-end warfare in which our ships would be high-end, peer and near-peer competitive warfare, in which our ships would be at risk, ships are going to sink. Sailors are not going to come home. We cannot continue to try and pull the wool over the eyes of people who watch what we do and have them believe that somehow we are capable of building impervious warships. We can't. The weapons are too wicked, and we will lose ships. Obviously, the survivability of the LCS has been a question for a decade. And the standards to which it's built, standards to which it's it is designed, are less than those that we built the DDG class to and the CG class to, which are less than what we build the aircraft carriers to. I think we have to continue to do our very best to put the best damage control, the best compartmentalization, the best reactive armor, whatever we can, to try to do the very best we can to make our ships survivable. But we can bankrupt ourselves in trying to create impervious ships. So in general, I would rather increase survivability by increasing lethality. I would rather the best defense being a good offense, number one. Number two, this question of numbers and whether losses in combat. I think it's a good one, Sal. I think it's a really good one. But it gets at so many more things than just combat. It gets at our pitiful industrial base. It gets at the fascination we have had over the last few years with capability at the expense of capacity. It gets at this sense that we can somehow continue to have this, the world's most global and lethal Navy, but do it more economically and on the cheap. We can't. We can't. Numbers matter. Dollars matter. The ability to continue to build ships during wartime matters. The ability to repair ships in combat matters. We have walked away from those, from expeditionary repair, from tenders, from anything that provides for a more survivable force, let alone the survivability of the ships. So I think I share some of your angst there, Sal. I don't know what the right answers are, but I don't think we're headed in the right direction to attain them.
Does this discussion of offensive threat or offensive mindset indicate a shift in the way we would build? You've identified a number of the issues we have, but would we be looking at more offensive, capable small ships like the as Lee puts on here the PHMs we had back when I was a youngster? Are there other better, more strike capable surface ships that are going to be designed as a result of this new thinking?
I don't know. I don't know. Anybody who's followed these matters recognizes that the Navy has a love-hate relationships with small ships. Typically, the people who serve on them love them. Typically, big Navy hates them. They have utility. They're hard. The economies of scale are lost. They're hard to sustain at the outer edges of the empire. There are all kinds of issues, and I don't believe I'm an expert in the small ship question. I just know that I want some. I want a lot. But I don't want them if it takes away from our ability to do the stuff that only the high-end forces can do. And until every Flight 2 Alpha DDG has an offensive weapon on it, until every single Flight 1 and Flight 2 DDG has a weapon on it that flies in excess of what Harpoon currently does, until we've fielded SM-6 throughout the fleet, until we have gotten the ships that we have comfortable with operating in these small, powerful groups, until we've provided them with persistent networking and ISR capability, organic, persistent networking to the SAG, until we've done those things, I would be hesitant to come out in favor of building a small a missile boat for one of an FPV of some kind. I want them, but only when we start to build the Navy that the country needs, that the country should have, and not while we're trying to build the Navy that the Navy that the country thinks it can afford. As long as cost remains our singular, I'm not just saying most important, our singular variable, I won't want to trade those trade that capability.
I want to go to a little bit of, I wouldn't call it a dark topic, but it's usually one I don't breach until my third scotch, and I haven't been drinking yet today. But I wanted to go there anyway, Brian, just to kind of pick your brain on something. In the last year, I've been on a World War One kick, and for obvious reasons. And it kind of goes with faith in technology. You know, when you look at specifically the British Army going into World War One, in their plans and their assumptions, they put a lot of faith in the theory and the peacetime training that they had with artillery, that if they just had enough guns with the right heads, that they would be able to blow their way through wire. And after a couple of days of heavy barrage, that they can blow their whistle, the infantry could get up. And they played that, and they walked into the Somme and everything else that followed after that. And we look at our Navy, a quarter century where we unquestionably unchallenged domination at sea, where unlike our Army and our Marine Corps, we really haven't been tested in combat to relearn some lessons and stuff. Are there, in the way that we're thinking and planning, where do you see that we may be vulnerable to a similar level of complacency? Whereas, like the Brits had their hints in the Boer War, but they assumed some of those lessons away. You know, is there one of the planning assumptions that we rely on and we assume right now that perhaps after the third scotch gives you some concerns on your end?
Yeah, hey, I think it's I am not a naval historian, primarily because you can't visit the battlefields, and that bothers me. And B.J. Armstrong, if he's listening, is quaking in his scotch right now. But I do have a real affinity for the book, The Rules of the Game. I think it's written by a man named Andrew Gordon. And it's about the battle. It's about the Royal Navy, and it's about the Battle of Jutland. Half the book, roughly, and it's a magnificent book, half the book deconstructs the Battle of Jutland in minute, minute-by-minute detail. And that half of the book, frankly, bores the crap out of me. The part of the book that fascinated me and continues to fascinate and haunt me is the part that deals with the Royal Navy from 1815 until 1914 and the rise of the peacetime Navy. The rise of the administrative peacetime Navy, the spirit of Nelson replaced by the efficiency of, you name the admiral, and I don't know exactly who it should be pinned on, but where individuality and rough training and innovation and an offensive spirit was trained out of the force. It is a stark story that he tells, and one that we should all be rereading. Now, do I think it's that bad in the U.S. Navy? No, I don't. I think, however, now is the time to change the slope of the line, and I think that's what distributed lethality is as a concept. It is the surface force saying, wait a second. What we do is not as relevant as it could be to what may come. We can be more helpful. We have to get back to some basics of sea control. We have to opportunistically put the right weapons. We have to train surface warriors as tacticians, and we have to value tactical innovation in a way that it hasn't been valued in the recent past. I think that's what's happening, at least in surface warfare. I think it's happening throughout the Navy, as a matter of fact. Surface warfare is trying to copy what the aviators have always done in terms of a focus on tactical proficiency. There's a lot of copying going on by the surface warfare, and I think we're waking up at the right time. So, I have some concerns, and if you want to get scared out of your wits, read The Rules of the Game. It'll take you a few weeks because it's a long book, but it's well worth it.
Well, that's an excellent way to end our show, Brian. You've been, we could go on for hours as usual for this show, but we've used up an hour of your time. The Super Bowl is beginning to come on, I guess, for another hour of hype before the game actually starts. I want to thank you for coming on with us today, and also extend my condolences for UVA's loss to Duke the other day. They'll probably make it up for it by beating my Tar Heels tomorrow.
I hope so.
I hope not. But anyway, thanks a lot for being on with us today, and we look forward to talking to you again.
It's a distinct pleasure, and thank you for doing this because it keeps a lot of people interested in important things.
Thank you very much again, Brian. Look forward to talking to you soon and seeing more of your work in the 2015.
Thank you. Take care.
You got it. Hey, and thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrat. Please join us next week where our guest will be Major General Wayne Grigsby, Jr., U.S. Army Commander, CJTF HOA. Have a great Super Bowl and, as always, a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Goddamn.